Welcome back to the Deep Dive. We are looking at a sack of papers today that, on the surface, seems purely about metallurgy.
Oh, yeah.
We've got phase transformations, crystal lattices, equations with Greek letters, the works.
All the good stuff.
Specifically, we're looking at a 1982 paper by HKDH Badesia from the University of Cambridge. But as we dug in, it became clear this isn't just about, you know, making steel harder.
No, not at all. It's basically a logic puzzle.
A logic puzzle. How so?
It's a classic scientific detective story. The culprit, in this case, a physical reaction inside the metal, it completely destroys the evidence of how it started.
So, like a locked room mystery, but on an atomic scale.
That's a great way to put it. Yeah.
All right. We're talking about something called Burst-Martensite. And the central tension in this paper is really about chaos versus order.
Hmm.
You have this reaction that's, well, explosive and chaotic, yet the entire goal of the paper is to prove that deep down it still follows a strict mathematical rule.
A linear rule, even. The mission here was to figure out how you measure the starting point of an explosion when the explosion itself happens at, like, the speed of sound and wipes out everything around it.
Finding the signal in a massive amount of noise.
Exactly.
Okay, so let's set the stage properly for everyone. We're looking at a specific type of phase transformation in steel. Now, I think most of us know steel can change its structure.
Right, that's heat treating.
Exactly, how we make swords or, you know, girders. But this paper focuses on a very specific, very aggressive kind of change.
It does. And to get the stakes, we have to distinguish between what we could call a polite steel transformation and this burst transformation.
Polite being the standard way steel hardens.
Correct. In most standard steels, the transformation is, well, it's well-behaved. When you cool the metal down, the crystal structure shifts from austenite.
The high-temperature phase.
The high-temperature phase, yes, to martensite, which is the hard phase. And it's usually progressive. You drop the temperature a few degrees, a few crystals flip over.
You drop more, a few more flip.
Precisely. It's predictable. You can graph it, and it just follows the temperature gradient perfectly.
We have equations for it. We can model it.
We can, but then you have the burst alloys.
The rebels.
The rebels, exactly. The paper focuses on a cocktail of iron, nickel, and carbon. To be precise, it's F28.0 WT%, I 0.41 WT%.
Okay.
And when you cool this alloy down, nothing happens. Nothing at all. For a long time, it resists the change, and then bam! Suddenly, at a specific low temperature, a massive chunk of the metal transforms all at once.
That's the burst.
That is the burst. It's violent. It's actually audible. You can sometimes hear a click or a ping from inside the metal when it happens.
Wow. And structurally, I imagine it's a mess.
A total mess. And the paper uses this fantastic term, autocatalysis, to describe why.
Right. That's key. Let's define that. In chemistry, it means a reaction that creates its own catalyst.
Mm-hmm.
But what does that mean in a solid block of metal?
It's all mechanical. Imagine one single plate of martensite forming.
Right.
When that crystal structure flips, it changes shape. It shears. And that physical shape change pushes on all the metal around it. It creates plastic deformation.
It strains the neighborhood.
Exactly. It strains the neighborhood. Now, in your polite steels, the area around it might just absorb that stress. But in these burst alloys, that strain is so powerful, it instantly triggers the next plate to form.
So the first one bullies the second one into existence.
It does. And that one bullies a third and a fourth. And because they're all pushing against each other, they form in this zigzag pattern, shooting off in all directions to accommodate the stress.
A chain reaction that moves at the speed of sound.
Pretty much. Which brings us to the big scientific problem. If you're a researcher trying to study the nucleation,
the very birth of that first plate,
you're out of luck. You just can't. By the time you can measure anything, the burst has already happened. You've got thousands of plates. You have no idea which one was the original parent.
And which ones were the children of the reaction.
Exactly. The data is completely swamped by the noise of the explosion.
It's like trying to figure out who started a riot when the whole city square is already brawling.
That's a perfect analogy. The dilemma was this. Does the initial nucleation of this burst martensite actually follow the standard laws of physics?
Right. There was a theory.
A theory represented by a couple of equations in the paper that says the number of starting points, the nuclei should be related linearly to the driving force.
So if I increase the driving force by X, the number of nuclei should go up by Y. It should be a nice clean line on a graph.
It should be. But nobody could prove it, because every time they tried to measure it in these alloys, they just got a vertical line, infinite transformation, instantly. The burst was hiding the physics.
So enter HKDH Badesia. It's 1982. He needs a way to decouple the nucleation from the autocatalysis.
He has to separate the parent from the children.
And to do that, he can't just use temperature. He needs to use mechanics. He needs to use stress.
This is where the experimental setup gets really, really clever. It's not some complex machine. It's just a very smart piece of geometry. He uses what's called a tapered tensile specimen.
Okay, let's visualize that.
Yeah.
Usually when you test metal strengths, you're pulling on a uniform rod, right? A cylinder.
Exactly. And if you pull on a uniform cylinder, the stress is the same all the way through it. But Hadeshia used a rod that was machined to be thick at one end and tapered down to be thin at the other.
So when he pulls on it, the stress is different at every single point along the rod.
That's it. Stress is force over area. So the thin end with its small area feels a huge amount of stress.
And the thick end feels very little.
Right. So he can run a whole continuous spectrum of experiments on one single piece of metal. It's incredibly efficient.
But the real genius is what that stress does to the burst.
Mm-hmm.
He prepares the sample high purity, homogenized at 1300 degrees Celsius, so it's perfectly uniform.
Mm-hmm.
And then he cools it down to minus 44 degrees Celsius.
Mm-hmm. And that temperature is crucial. It's cold, but it's just above the natural burst temperature for this alloy.
So the metal is ready to transform, but it hasn't pulled the trigger yet.
It's metastable. It's just waiting for a nudge.
And that nudge is the stress. He applies the load.
He does. And we know that pulling on the metal tensile stress, it helps martensite to form. It gives it a little extra energetic kick.
It helps the crystal flip.
It helps the crystal flip. But, and this is the key, stress is directional. Temperature is just heat. It's everywhere, a scalar. But stress is a vector. It pulls in one specific line.
So he's introducing a bias into the system.
He's biasing the whole system. Remember that chaotic zigzag of the burst?
Yeah.
That happens because the plates are trying to accommodate each other in every direction. They're fighting for space. But when you pull the metal hard, you are effectively telling the crystals, look, if you're going to flip, you're going to flip in a way that aligns with this pull.
You're forcing them into a specific lane.
We call it variant selection. In any crystal, there are many possible orientations the new martensite plate could take. Without stress, they take all of them. Chaos. But with high stress, one or two of those orientations become very, very favorable.
And the others become very difficult.
Exactly. So the zigzag pattern becomes almost impossible because the zag direction is now fighting against this huge external stress.
If they can't zigzag, they can't trigger that runaway autocatalytic explosion.
They can't. They have to form nicely, one by one or in parallel sets. By applying a constraint, he forces the material to reveal its orderly nature.
He forces it to be disciplined.
And you can actually see this. Figure 2 in the paper has these micrographs of the sample, and it's amazing.
It is really striking. Let's describe it. If you look at the thick end of the rod where the stress was low, what do you see?
You see the classic mess. It looks like lightning bolts, jagged lines, patches of dark transformation going every which way.
The autocatalysis just took over.
It burst, yep. The stress wasn't high enough to control it.
But then you look at the thin end. The high stress end.
It's beautiful. The chaos is gone. The plates are organized. They're running parallel to each other, inclined at about 45 degrees to the pole.
They look like a plowed field.
They do. It looks like a totally different material, but it's the same alloy, just under different rules.
So by applying that high stress, he suppressed the autocatalysis.
He stopped the children from forming, which means the plates he's counting in that high stress section, those are the parents, the original nuclei.
And once he has a reliable count of the parents, he can finally check the math.
Which brings us to figure 1. He plots the amount of martensite that formed against the stress, which is his stand-in for the driving force. And for the very first time in one of these burst alloys, he gets a straight line.
Linearity, the holy grail of physics.
It proved it. It proved that the underlying mechanism of nucleation in these crazy explosive alloys is exactly the same as in the polite, boring steels.
It obeys the same thermodynamic laws.
Yes. It was just that the deafening noise of the burst was hiding that clean, linear signal all along.
Yet is such a significant finding. It validates that entire theory of nucleation.
It does. And there's a subtle but really important detail he had to get right. The paper distinguishes between stress-assisted and strain-induced nucleation.
Right. I wanted to ask about that. If you pull too hard on metal, don't you just start to damage it?
You do. If you pull it past its yield point, you start creating massive plastic deformation. You're tearing up the crystal lattice itself, creating new defects.
And defects are where nucleation likes to happen.
Exactly. So if he pulled too hard, he would have been creating new nucleation sites, planting new seeds, basically.
Like strain-induced nucleation.
Right. And that would ruin the experiment. He was trying to count the seeds that were already there.
He wanted to measure the existing population, not create a new one.
Correct. He wanted stress-assisted nucleation. You're just helping the existing defects to pop. And he had to be very careful to keep the stress in just the right range to do that.
And how do we know he pulled it off?
The linearity of that graph. If he were creating new defects, the graph would probably start to curve upwards or get erratic. The fact that it stayed so beautifully linear suggests he was successfully measuring just the growth from the original nuclei.
It's really a testament to such thoughtful experimental design. He didn't brute force it with 1,000 samples.
No.
He designed one sample that contained the entire answer.
The taper tells the whole story. It's a physical gradient of the laws of physics laid out on a single piece of metal.
So, okay, we've solved the mystery. The burst hides a linear law. But let's zoom out. Why does this matter for anyone who isn't a metallurgist?
Well, it comes down to predictability and safety. We use high-strength alloys in very extreme environments. Think cryogenics, aerospace, heavy industry.
And you really don't want your material to behave unexpectedly in a rocket engine.
Exactly. A burst transformation, if it's not controlled, can be dangerous. That violent volume change we mentioned, it can cause microcracking. It can leave the material full of internal stresses you never planned for.
So you need to know exactly when and how that transformation is going
to
happen.
And you need to be able to model it. By proving this linear relationship, Padacea gave engineers a valid mathematical basis to simulate these materials. You don't have to treat it as a random explosion anymore. You can treat it as a calculated variable.
It's interesting to think about that idea of constrained chaos. You take a system that naturally wants to be chaotic. You apply a directional constraint, in this case stress, and suddenly it organizes itself.
It's a principle you see in a lot of complex systems, really. I mean, think about a crowd of people in a panic. It's chaotic.
Autocatalytic, even. Panic triggers more panic.
Yeah. Everyone runs in every direction, like those zigzag plates. But if you put up barriers, channel the flow, you apply a stress in terms of direction.
You get a cue. You get order.
You get order. Or even in data analysis, sometimes you have a data set that just looks like total noise. But if you filter it through the right variable, if you apply the right stress to the data, a pattern emerges.
And that's essentially what Padacea did, just physically. He filtered the reaction through a stress field to see the underlying pattern.
He proved that complexity often just masks a much simpler rule. The burst looks infinitely complex, but the engine driving it is a simple linear equation.
And that's the job of material science, isn't it? To look past the messy macroscopic result and find the clean microscopic rule.
That is the core of the discipline. We try to understand the atom so we can trust the bridge.
I just want to go back to the sheer ingenuity of the experiment one last time. It's 1982. There are no supercomputers to simulate this.
Not like today, no.
Just a furnace, a machine to pull the rod, and a really clever idea about geometry.
It's a great reminder that sometimes the best solution isn't the most high-tech one. It's the one that best understands the fundamental problem. He knew the problem was directional chaos, so he applied a directional solution.
And in doing so, he validated a theory that had been stuck on the hypothetical pile for years.
Equation 2 finally got its day in court.
Well, that seems like a perfect place to wrap up this deep dive. We started with exploding metal and ended with a validation of fundamental thermodynamics.
Not a bad journey for a few grams of iron and nickel.
Not bad at all. To everyone listening, we hope this gave you a new perspective on what's happening inside the materials all around you. It's easy to think of steel as just a solid, dead block of matter.
But under the right conditions, it's incredibly dynamic. And remember, next time you see something that looks like total chaos, ask yourself, is it really random? Or is it just a simple pattern that's waiting for the right kind of stress to reveal itself?
That is something to think about. Thanks for listening, everyone. We'll catch you on the next deep dive.